On this episode of the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, we speak with astronomer, MUFON chief photo and video analyst, and creator of SkyTour Radio and SkyTour Livestream on YouTube, Mr. Mark D'Antonio. We'll also dive into some alien species and famous UFO encounters. So let's blast off!
Do aliens exist and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast. I am your captain, Ghost Joe, and I am going to lead you on a journey of interstellar entertainment. How do you like that? And that was not AI written, okay? That's all me. That's all me off the top of my head. So how do you like them apples? Anyway, before I get into some stupid things and start saying all the ums, and all that good stuff that I hate saying, let's talk a little bit about UFOs and alien species. Let's start with the alien species first. So let's begin with the most famous of all of the alien species, the ones that haunt you in your dreams, the ones that come in tall and short order, whichever you prefer. Let's talk about the grays. These small gray-skinned beings with large black eyes are frequently reported in abduction cases, as you've heard, as you've seen all the movies, right? They're said to be telepathic and possibly involved in genetic experiments. Some believe they're monitoring humanity, while others fear their intentions are more sinister. Crazy, right? Freaking grays, bro. And now you got the Nordics. The Nordics look like Thor, I guess. You know, they're tall, blonde humanoid beings who supposedly warn us about global dangers. They appear in many accounts as benevolent protectors, contrasting sharply with the eerie, emotionless grays. So yeah, they're pretty much like the polar opposites of grays. You know, these are the good guys. These are the guys that come to our rescue with, you know, Thor's golden hammer and, you know, come and help us out. Then we have another very, very infamous one, the reptilians. They're known for their supposed infiltration of human society. You know, I've done pieces about it where people say that Justin Bieber and all these politicians and celebrities are reptilians. And, you know, apparently they have infiltrated human society. Some conspiracy theories suggest that they're among us, that they've been among us for centuries, manipulating political and corporate power from behind the scenes. Okay. Those are reptilians. We all know about that. There's a bunch of books on them too. You could probably check them out. Probably pretty interesting as well. Then you have the insectoids. Okay. The insectoids are highly intelligent. When I think of insectoids, I think of that guy that, you know, played in Full Metal Jacket, that was in Men in Black, you know, when he was like the big insect guy. That's how I see insectoids, right? So they're highly intelligent, insect-like creatures, often described in telepathic interactions with abductees. Some claim they oversee interstellar governance or scientific advancements. So they're pretty smart, these insectoids, you know? And then you have the Pleiadians. Pleiadians, let's say it like that, okay? They are another fascinating group. Humanoids, apparently, originating from the Pleiades star cluster, often associated with spiritual enlightenment. So yeah, so Pleiadians, I guess that's how you say it. I don't know, I've tried to look up how to say it, and that's kind of what I got. So yeah, that's what we're going with. Finally, we have the tall whites. They are pale-skinned, highly intelligent beings rumored to have secret interactions with military officials. So these are the guys that go behind the scenes and talk to the military about, you know, hiding them and all this good stuff. So yeah, those are the tall whites. So yeah, those are some of the main species, but apparently there's a bunch of books on alien species as well. There's a lot of alien species apparently. So yeah, check that out. So now we have some chilling UFO encounters that we're going to go over. Some of you probably know it. Some of you probably don't. But let's go over it anyway. Because, you know, that's what you came here for, right? So let's talk about the Pascagoula incident in 1973. I actually made a TikTok about this, so you could go check out our TikTok or YouTube, and you'll see a quick video that I did on this. This Pascagoula incident happened in 1973, where two fishermen claimed that they were taken aboard a craft by robotic beings with strange claw-like hands. Then there's the Travis Walton case. That's the big one, right? They made the movie Fire in the Sky that scared the crap out of me when I was a teenager. I saw that in the movie theater. Awesome, awesome movie. And I'd love to have Travis Walton on the show so he could give us a little bit of a, you know, what actually happened in real life compared to what happened in the movies. I'd love to hear it straight from his mouth and ask him some questions that maybe he hasn't heard before. So this is an invitation to you, Travis. If you're listening, please come find me at 845-600-0744, or you could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com, and we'll set that interview up. And that goes for anybody that has any paranormal experiences as well. So definitely utilize that. You could actually win some cool prizes as well. So now let's talk a little bit about the Travis Walton case. That happened in 1975, where Travis and his logging crew saw a bright craft in the woods. Walton approached it and was allegedly abducted for 5 days before mysteriously reappearing. So yeah, that was an insane, I mean, you could read up on it. It's insane. I did a TikTok about that also as well a few months back. So you could also look that up on our TikTok, YouTube, and all that good stuff. Then you have actually the man that we're going to be talking to in a few minutes. Mark D'Antonio himself had a very famous case abduction as well. Of course, I'm going to let him tell it in detail and stuff. But what happened with him was he had experienced time slips away. You know, he had seen this UFO and then he doesn't remember what happened. He went on a school trip. And he has no idea. He saw these bright lights in the sky. And then the next thing he remembers, he was back on the bus and he had no idea what happened. So yeah, missing time and all that. And that's a very, very big thing. I don't know how to say it right now. A very, very big thing with alien abductees. So missing time. Then you have the Nimitz Tic Tac UFO incident. That was in 2004. And it's another incredible case where U.S. Navy pilots witnessed an object moving in ways that defied physics, vanishing from sight without any visible propulsion. From abductees' eerie experiences to strange government interactions, these stories leave us wondering, right? Are aliens watching us, guiding us, or something much more complex? Interview with Mark D'Antonio. You're going to love it, by the way. We are going to check in with our resident UFO guy, Mr. John Wright, about all things UFO that he's been up to, conferences that he's been speaking at, as well as articles that have been written about him, and the Pine Bush UFO Fair that's going to be coming around in June. So definitely check it out. You're not going to want to miss it.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, everybody. It's been a while since I've had time to do a segment. Track season is always kind of a busy time for me, but this year there have been some additional things that have been added to my usual chaotic schedule. Just a few weeks ago, I was asked to do a talk for a group of women in Poughkeepsie regarding MUFON. It was going to include what it does, how to become an investigator, what a typical investigation is like, and some general information about UFOs in the Hudson Valley. Unfortunately, I was unable to attend that meeting because I had a few runners that wound up making it for to the Adidas Indoor National Championship meet, which was held down in Virginia Beach. Lance actually came up with a really good idea, and he said, hey, if you can't be there in person, why don't you just do a video? So we did a video as a stand-in. I think the video was in total maybe about 20 minutes or so. So the day that I was supposed to appear, they actually played the video. To my understanding, it was actually really well received. About a week after that, I had received a text message from Lance. Apparently, a woman who was part of the group loved the video and then asked if I would be willing to be part of a panel on UFOs. And this was actually going to be part of what they refer to as the Philip K. Dick Film Festival, which takes place in Manhattan every year. I had no clue about this thing, never knew this thing existed, but really glad that I was part of it. And my wife actually attended the day with me, the festival with me. It was held at the Producers Club in the Theater District. And the club is actually it's a really cool place. I've never been in a place like this. And if I remember correctly, it has like five small theaters in it. And each theater even though they're rather small, has a seating capacity of about, I think it's 50 people for each one. The whole purpose of the festival is to help aspiring filmmakers to get their information out there. So they produce these movie shorts, or they produce what is referred to as a proof of concept film. For some of them, it's just to express their passion for filmmaking. For others, it's to try and find people who want to invest in full feature films. So we had one gentleman who can't remember his last name. His first name was Spiro. And what he did was he talked about the importance of distribution in the film world. And he took up the first session. During the second session, I was asked to take the stage for basically a Q&A session. The session initially was only supposed to last for, I think it was about 30 minutes, because they had the whole entire day blocked off into like 30 minute segments and 1 hour segments. So they had allotted, it was about 30 minutes for this segment. Once the Q&A session started, it kept going for, it was almost an hour and a half. They'd actually skipped a couple of segments because the people that were there, not just the people, but also the gentleman who was the moderator, I guess, if you want to call him that, they kept coming up with questions that they had, not just about the Hudson Valley, but also about just questions in general. So initially I was brought in just to talk about Pine Bush UFO sightings and things that had occurred within the Hudson Valley. And this was supposed to be linked to one of the short films that was being presented at the festival. So as I said, I was asked questions about Pine Bush, which led to questions about the Hudson Valley. And then that eventually led to questions about some of the more modern things that are going on, like whistleblowers. And like I said, I could go on and on and on. More recently, within the last week, a Hudson Valley newspaper reached out to Joe and asked if I would be willing to do an interview. The paper's called the Shawangunk Journal, and the article was written by a newcomer to the Hudson Valley, a girl by the name of Olivia Sipple. The article was well written and focused mainly on the UFOs in the Hudson Valley. Only bummer was that the podcast didn't make it into the article. I said to Joe when I texted him, I'm like, sorry, dude, man, I tried. I said, I dropped your name. I dropped the show name a few times. Unfortunately, it did not make the cut in the article. If you can go online, if you live in the Hudson Valley, you can find the Shawangunk Journal. As I was joking around with my wife and my family member, I made the front page. It's actually a really good article. I was kind of shocked. I thought it would be a lot of like tinfoil hat stuff. But Olivia did a really good job with it. Last thing that I'll mention is that we do have the Pine Bush UFO fair coming up real soon. It's only going to be a few weeks, June 7th to be exact. It's an all-day affair. We have a lot of different activities. We have things for kids. We have things for adults. I sent a link to Joe with all of the information. Hopefully, he'll be able to post it to the show notes. We usually have somewhere between 5,000 to 6,000 people that attend this thing. They're going to have a dance. They're going to have a costume thing. They're going to do like a ball gown kind of thing. It's just really, really funny, some of the things that we do. I believe they're going to have some other activities, like a cornhole, beanbag toss kind of thing. And then during the day, we also have what we refer to as the speaker's tent. So I was actually asked to be a speaker during that day, where we have all these different guest speakers from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And I'm not quite sure what my time slot is yet. I'm still waiting for confirmation on that. As soon as I get that, I will pass it along. We do have also what they call the conference, which would be later that night. And you would have to pay to see those people. We're going to have Mark D'Antonio. We're going to have Nick Pope and a couple other people that will be there to speak. So if you're not doing anything on the weekend of June 7th, we would love to see you. And if you could, stop by the tent, say hello, or stop by the museum and say hello. Thanks a lot, guys. Back to you, Joe.
Thank you for that awesome segment, as usual, John. I can't wait to go to this festival. I really want to go this year. Me and my daughter had a great time last year, so I hope to attend. Hopefully, maybe we could even try and get a table, or something, or some kind of presence for the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast. You know, I do enough for the paranormal community, don't I? I mean, come on. Anyway, here's the moment you've been waiting for. This is my interview with astronomer Mark D'Antonio. You're going to love it. Stay tuned, listen to the whole thing, and check out all of his links in the show notes. So on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, you ready?
Tonight, we're peering into the cosmos and unraveling mysteries that blur the lines between science and the unexplained. Joining us is Mark D'Antonio, a renowned astronomer, UFO analyst, and the creative force behind FX Models. As the chief photo and video analyst for MUFON, Mark has spent years investigating extraordinary sightings and separating fact from fiction. But his expertise doesn't stop there. Mark is also the host of SkyTour Radio and SkyTour Livestream, where he brings the wonders of the universe into the sharp focus for stargazers around the globe. So how you doing, Mark? How's it going?
Great. How you doing, man?
Good, man. Good. It's been a little bit. I know you probably don't remember me, but I had actually attended one of your lectures at the Danbury Library a few months back
for the UFO week, I believe. Recently.
Yeah, yeah. About 4 months ago, yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot happens in time.
Of course. I actually had went to go see Al Santariga.
Yeah. I know Al, good friend. Nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Got tons of experiences and stories and stuff too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. So how did you get started in astronomy and UFO research?
When I was 9 years old is when it all happened, because I had this thing happen when I went to a pond here in Connecticut with my school. And we were doing a field trip, end of the year field trip. And we went to this pond called Burr Pond, which is in Torrington, Connecticut. And when I got on the bus, I had a little bag lunch. I remember sitting down on the bus. I remember the bus ride. I remember getting there. I remember getting off the bus. And the next thing I remember, I'm getting on the bus with my little bag lunch, uneaten. And I was like, wait, when are we going to the pond? And the kids are all excited and jumping around. They said, we're there all day, you idiot. Where were you? And it's like, I had no knowledge of that entire day. It's all gone. So I had this weird missing time. And the weird thing is that when I got home, I put my lunch on the table. My mother said, why didn't you eat your lunch? I said, I don't know. And she's like, well, go outside and play. I'll call you when it's time for dinner. Okay. I went outside. And I remember all of a sudden feeling really strange. The next thing I know, I'm having seizures and these convulsions. And one of the neighborhood kids alerted my mother. They called an ambulance. I remember going to the hospital in this ambulance. And I remember not being scared at all. I remember that I thought it was cool. They're running the siren. Yeah, and I asked them, will you run the siren? Oh, yeah. Okay, Mr. Okay, Marky. So they ran the siren. You know, they said, well, we do it anyway. And I thought, wow, this is all for me. This is cool. I didn't even think of it as anything weird other than like a playtime thing. It was weird. It's like I knew it wasn't serious. And they got there and they basically said, well, he must have got a concussion or something, because I had a bump on my forehead right here. But that's because when I was having the seizures, I was pounding my head on the ground like this and embedding dirt in my forehead. And I remember seeing ants crawling around going, oh, look at the ants, you know, trying not to hit the ants. You know, it's just, you know, and again, I was detached. It wasn't even me, you know. So then I got there at the hospital, and the worst part was when the nurse was pulling the little pieces of dirt out of my forehead with tweezers. It stung when she was pulling those little things out. And it's like an abrasion. And anytime you touch an abrasion, you know how it hurts. So that was the worst part. Well, anyway, when I ended up getting out of there, they said, well, just watch them, you know, keep them up a little while. Don't worry. It's not a problem. And it wasn't. It never happened again. I never had another seizure. Okay. However, in the next few days, I started looking up and thinking, you know, there's something going on up there. I don't know what it was, but I felt like there was something going on. So I asked my parents, can you buy me a telescope? And a family friend gave them the money to buy me a telescope, because my parents didn't have money at all. So they bought me this little 2.4-inch refractor. It was made by the company called Scope, and it was teal green. you know, it kind of looked like a industrial green or something. And it was fun. It was a Japanese telescope, as far as I knew. And I had this zoom eyepiece where I could twist it while zooming in the moon, zoom out. Oh, man, it was really great. And I kept finding myself looking at stars and just staring at stars, wondering if there was anybody looking back. I don't know why I thought that. But from that point where I had that missing time forward, I started thinking, I'm going to be an astronomer. I couldn't even really say the word when I was nine. I said, I want to be an astronomer, you know. And again, so, and I never wavered from age nine all the way to college. I knew I was going to be an astronomer. And I just, wow. It was like, that's not even a question, you know. I built a space station plan that I sent to NASA, you know, as a nine-year-old. I did it on notebook paper. A scientist looked at it, sent it back with all kinds of wonderful comments, and then he sent me a box full of model kits, books, brochures, cloth mission patches from the missions thus far, and a letter, a nice letter. And the letter was, boy, you know, you should stick around in the space program. You have great potential. You said some things that we're actually just doing now in the thought process, and things like carbon scrubbers for, you know, scrubbing the air clean of carbon dioxide. Okay. I felt that had to happen because we expel carbon dioxide. I was a science geek as a kid. So I read every book on stuff. I knew how it worked kind of thing to the level that a nine-year-old could. And then I realized we got to get rid of carbon dioxide in the air because that's toxic to us. I've read that in a lot of books, so I didn't experiment to know that chemically what it does to your body. Now I do, but I didn't then. But then I ended up just saying, well, you know, I'm going to do this. So this scientist at NASA spurred me on, and away I went. And I never talked to him again until, it was 40 years after the event. After making this space station plan, I literally found him online. I wrote him an email and said, you don't remember me, I know, but then I explained what I just told you. He wrote back within 20 minutes and he said, oh my gosh, I don't remember you. You're correct. But that's exactly what I did when I was working at NASA. He says, I would do that kind of stuff. He goes, it's so good. You're the only one that's ever contacted me to tell me how it went. I said, well, I did. And, you know, I did. And because, you know, you made such an impression on me. And it says, because of you, you know, in part, I became an astronomer. I didn't tell him about the missing time or anything. But it's true that without his push, I probably wouldn't have jumped into astronomy. But I will say this, you know, that guy that I'm talking about is someone by the name of Bert Lee. Now, he goes by the name Gentry Lee. And he's the JPL head of all outer space projects. All the Mars rovers are his. New Horizons probe to Pluto and to, you know, Ultima Thule, the Kuiper Belt object. Those are his. Vesta's flyby and the Ceres flyby. Dawn project, the Dawn probe, all his. He was in charge of all remote outer space. He was part of the remote, space directorate. I don't know which, but it's all robotic missions to the outer planets, Galileo, Cassini. Okay. He was in charge of all these things. He was the chief engineer on all of them. Most of, I think all of them, trying not to name some he's not, but anyway, he was there for many years. He's still, he may be retired now, but it's interesting that guy who is so well-placed in the industry is the guy that got me into astronomy. And he thought, he says, oh, we got to keep in touch, you know, so it's been kind of fun.
That's excellent. That's awesome. That's a great story too.
Yeah, it's just awesome. The way it was.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you explain what MUFON is, what you do, and possibly maybe something that you remember, you know, like either a case that you worked on or something that really kind of resonated with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's many cases that resonate with me. And none for the reason you might think. One of the problems, first of all, MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network. Now, I got into it. I got into it when I was 11 years old. Okay. And that was in 1971.
Wow.
Okay. So yeah, I'm an older guy, but let me say this. It was still called the Midwest UFO Network back then. And the MUFON Journal was a stapled page of mimeographed purple pages with that ink. You go, and the ink smelled so good. You know, it was kind of weird. And so that's what it was. And so I ate that thing up. I just loved reading stories of UFO encounters and stuff like that. And I had a feeling that like what we know today was coming. I knew back then, because when I was getting my degree in astronomy, I said to the director of my observatory at the university, I said, you know, I think it's a populated universe, Art. His name is Arthur. And he goes, oh, why do you say that, Mr. D'Antonio? Very prim and proper guy. Suspenders, looked over the top of his glasses at you at all times. Probably because they're so dirty. They were filthy. You know, he was always digging through books. And I said, well, you look at us. You know, we're carbon-based beings. You know, carbon's the fourth most abundant element in the whole universe, Art. So it stands to reason that there's probably life out there that's carbon-based. He goes, uh-huh. I said, yeah. And then, okay, we're also bilaterally symmetric. We're the same on one side as the other. And all life forms on this planet are symmetric in one way or another. Bilateral symmetry, like us. Okay. Radial symmetry, like tulips and other flowers. Okay. And pentamerism, like starfish, five-sided, you know. Odd symmetries, but that's what it was, you know. And you know, we have our octagonal symmetry, you know, we have octopuses, you know, mollusca, you know. So there's all kinds of symmetry with every single life form. And that's probably due to DNA, which is in every life form. So we have DNA, we have carbon, we have oxygen, okay. We have this symmetry. And this is something I said to him that I think is the fundamental underlayment to life and universe. I think that this is what we'll find with life and universe, is that it's going to exhibit one or more of these characteristics for sure. You know, and he looked at me and he goes, uh-huh. He says, are you finished? I go, yeah, yes, sir. Yeah, I'm done. He goes, okay, get back in the observatory, work on your project, and leave Captain Kirk to us. And so I walked away. And you may have heard me say that story before, but the truth is that, you know, when I got my astronomy degree, I got my degree in 1983, and then I went back in 1988 when the first exoplanet was confirmed. Okay. I walked into the observatory, you smell the old wood from the 1800s as the building was old and just stunningly kept. Okay, a true academic institution, if there ever was one. You walk in there, you could smell Clyde Tombaugh, who found Pluto. You could just smell the astronomers that have been there over the decades and centuries. And I was walking in the creaky wooden floors toward his office, and I could hear him bellowing on the phone. Whenever anyone was on the phone, you could hear them throughout the whole building, this dull echo all throughout the walls. And I could hear him on the phone. I walk in, and I didn't tell him I was coming. I just peek around the corner and look at him in his chair, and he looks at me, all right, and he moves away from the phone. He says, it was only one planet, and he goes back to his call because he knew that that's probably why I was there. In other words, my comment resonated with him. He remembered it, which I thought was funny. Right. Now, it was some years later, and I wrote a book on exoplanets and astronomy and life in the universe. And many of the things I'm telling you now are in the book. In the book, I called The Populated Universe, because that's what I said to him. I said, Art, I think it's a populated universe. And, you know, back then, it wasn't good for an astronomer to say something like that. You know, because that's like saying, I bet you believe in little green men. That would be the next thing that he would say, right? Well, I do believe in other beings. I think they're already here. In fact, one of my most popular lectures, which I think you saw at the Danbury Library, was on the interdimensional nature of the universe and how they probably travel in a fifth dimension to get here quickly, which obviates the need for sticking to the speed limit of the universe that we have in our four dimensions, which is, you know, the speed of light. Right.
Right.
So we don't have that in this fifth dimension. And I'm sure that's how they travel. I really, really, really feel that that's actually how they're here and why they elude us.
So actually, that was actually one of my questions that I really wanted to ask you, because I tried to explain it after I had seen the lecture, and I'm like, I'm totally butchering this. That's why I'm like, I got to have you on the show so you could explain it better about how you feel that they travel. And also, I remember you telling a story about you being in the submarine as yes. well.
Yep.
So if you could go sure, over that, sure. that'd be awesome.
Yeah, first of all, you know, my feelings about how they travel are based on Robert Schroeder, a good friend of mine. He wrote a book called Solving the UFO Enigma. And in it, it's packed with equations and stuff that no one's going to understand unless they understand string theory and advanced physics. So I understand that he got the book. He wrote the book so that he could get this out there. But he didn't write the book for the everyday person to read, unfortunately. And I kind of told him that. Great guy, good friend, and I always give him credit, you know, when I talk about this stuff, because it is from his work that I did a springboard off of it. All right. So he's the basis for everything I say, in part. I mean, I've done my own research too, of course, but I'm also thinking about what he's done as well. And I think that he deserves the mention as well. And Bob Schroeder would be a great person to have on your show. The idea goes back to when Kaluza and Klein, two scientists, physicists, were looking at potential particles that could be useful, is the best way I can say it. And they hypothesized that there might be this Kaluza-Klein particle out there. Now, what's the benefit? What's it mean? I'll get to that. Okay. But the Kaluza-Klein particle isn't just a particle. It's potentially a graviton. Now, for this, I got to take you back to the fundamental forces in quantum mechanics. What does that mean? We have four fundamental forces in the universe, okay? We have the strong force. That's the thing that binds atoms together. It holds protons close to each other. Those are all positive charges trying to flee from one another. But the strong force is really, really strong, the most powerful force. But it acts over an exceedingly small distance inside the nucleus of an atom, okay? The next force is the weak force. This is the force that allows a neutron, okay, a neutral particle, to become a proton, okay, through something called beta decay. And that's the reason why we have a periodic table full of elements. And that's the reason why we are here. Because hydrogen, the very first element to be created in the universe, was able to become helium through fusion, but it was also helium that becomes lithium and beryllium and, you know, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, and so on, all the way down the periodic table through this this slow process of neutron capture, which then creates new elements by making neutrons into protons. So if you have a, let's do a simple one. Let's say you have a hydrogen atom, and it's a proton with an electron and a cloud around it. Okay, we used to say a particle of it orbiting, but it's a cloud. Okay, now that proton can be joined by a neutron. Now, to bring a neutron in doesn't require nearly as much energy as to bring another proton in, okay? Because the neutron doesn't have any charge, so it's not being repelled by the proton. So we could join the proton in the nucleus easier than another proton could be coming in, because that requires an exceedingly higher amount of force. But the neutron can join easier. And when you add a neutron to a hydrogen atom's nucleus, you go from having a hydrogen atom to deuterium. Okay, that's a hydrogen atom with a neutron. And that's a different variation of the same atom. It's called an isotope. Anytime you add a neutron to any atom, all right, nucleus, it's called an isotope. So, you know, atoms have protons and electrons. Okay, you add a neutron into the nucleus of any atom, and now you have an isotope of that original atom. It's like a different family of the same atom, different version, okay? So that neutron in that core of in the nucleus of the atom can spontaneously become another proton. And that spontaneous process is this decay process. The weak force in quantum mechanics allows for this to happen. And it sort of mediates, okay, the mediator is another particle which actually allows that a neutron to become a proton. What does all this mean? It means that that hydrogen atom with a neutron in the nucleus, that neutron becomes another proton. And now you've got an atom with two protons. And what's that? That's helium. Okay, so now we've gone from one proton to two protons. So it's a little step. But we went from a hydrogen atom to a helium atom. Boom, now we have a helium atom from a deuterium, from a hydrogen isotope. So all it means is that neutrons change to protons. And that contributes to having new elements in our periodic table. And that's the weak force that allows that. So we have the strong force, which holds those together. Okay. We have the weak force, which allows the neutrons to become protons and make more elements. Then we have light is the third quantum force, the electromagnetic force. And that is an interesting combination of a magnetic and electric field traveling like this to each other. That's a whole other thing. But light we can describe, okay, in a number of ways. We can describe it as a wave. Okay, you know about light waves. We can also describe it as a photon, can't we? A particle of light, right? Well, in the same way, we can describe a electron as a particle, but we can also, because it's a cloud, as we talked about, we can also describe it with an equation, a probability equation. What's the probability that the electron is here, not here? I mean, we have the ability to do that. So we can talk about fundamental forces in these dual terms, a particle nature and a wave nature. Okay. And particle and wave natures are very, very important to our fundamental forces. What's the fourth force? Well, again, we have the strong, we have the weak, we have light. Okay. And we have gravity. You see how gravity's kind of outside the picture here? It's over there. There it is. Hi, I'm over here. It's over there outside. It's just outside. Why? It's sort of half in and half out, isn't it? Well, the reason it's half in and half out, okay, in other words, to our four dimensions. Our four dimensions are X, Y, and Z moving through time, right? Well, light and everything else, the protons, electrons, muons, gluons, and so on in an atom, all those additional particles, they all interact within our four dimensions. Okay? Light starts and stops in our four dimensions. Shine a flashlight. The light beam doesn't just vanish into nothingness. It hits the wall or it goes up into the sky where it keeps on going to the moon and beyond or whatever. Okay? It stops here, though. You hit it, you turn it on in your hands, and the beam stops at the wall. Okay. Gravity, however, permeates everything. Gravity is the oddball. You know, we know how to manipulate gravity through equations. We can talk about the value of gravity. We can use it to apply to this bottle if we want to send it to space. We can send this to space and we give it a certain velocity so it escapes Earth's gravity. Okay, that's the escape velocity. And so that escape velocity is something that we can calculate. We know it well. We've gone all the way to the Kuiper belts outside of our main solar system using just the calculation to know what the gravity is. And without even knowing what gravity really is. Okay. So to understand what gravity is sort of like where this Kaluza-Klein particle comes in. Why is that? Well, here's the thing with gravity. We know how to calculate it. Like I said, we know how to use it in equation. The equation of gravity is the force of two between two masses of gravity is capital G, big M over little, you know, big M, little m over R squared, the distance between the centers of them. So the Earth is the big M, moon is the little m in this particular case. And so F equals GMM over R squared. We can calculate the gravitational force between the Earth and the moon. Yeehaw, and we'll get it almost exactly right. Okay, now, the problem is that's just calculating the force of gravity. But what about doing something like we can do with light? What if we want to reflect gravity? Anti-gravity, right? What if we want to reflect it? We can't reflect it. We have no idea how to reflect it. Gravity acts on us no matter what we're behind, whether we're in a lead room, whether we're, you know, surrounded by, you know, anything, you know, unicorns, okay, whatever. But you know, either way, gravity still affects us, right? We can block out light, put up a wall, light doesn't get in. We can reflect it, throw up a mirror, light gets bounced off. We can't do that to gravity. Gravity keeps right on going. Why is that? The idea is that gravity, unlike light, which exists in our four dimensions, gravity doesn't exist fully in our four dimensions. It's half in and it's half out. Okay. One part of gravity is in our four dimensions, X, Y, Z, moving through time. The other half of gravity is outside that in another dimension. We call that a fifth dimension. Okay. There's the fifth dimension. Okay. So we have four dimensions and a fifth dimension. And so everything we use to calculate for rockets and to go to planets is in our X, Y, and Z movement through time. But the fifth dimension is the only place where gravity lives. It's the other end. So gravity either starts or stops in our four dimensions, but not both. So maybe we're watching the end result of gravity, or maybe we are just seeing the masses generating gravity, but it terminates in another dimension. And so how would an alien race who's discovered this make use of it? Well, they would make use of it by trying to harness that fifth dimension, which is exactly what Kaluza and Klein would hypothesize with this Kaluza-Klein hypothesis. And the thing that's interesting about it is that if you can generate these Kaluza-Klein particles and put them around your ship, okay, then because you're originating them in our four dimensions, but because the other half of them is in the fifth dimension, which is not within our four dimensions, if you generate a big, giant number of those around your ship, you're going to get pulled into the fifth dimension because that's the other end where they're going. Okay? That's the idea behind this hypothesis. And it's sort of a simplified view of it. But the thing that's interesting with this is that this means now that your ship has a number of advantages. Okay? If you want to travel from one point to another, you leave the four-dimensional space you're in, your X, Y, and Z coordinate, okay, at a certain time, and you vanish and you just disappear. You go into the fifth dimension out to the side somewhere, wherever it is, and then you re-enter at another location. Bing, and now you're in a different location. You didn't travel the distance between the old location and the new location. You vanished from the old location and appeared at the new location. And that's how it works. So that doesn't violate any physics, actually, because you're just doing a punch out, punch in thing. You're doing a punch out. Okay. Yeah. Punch out and punch in. And so you're not even needing engines. All you need is the ability to generate particles and then stop generating particles and actually kind of have an entry point technology that allows you to go to a certain spot. And that means you have to map the universe. Maybe it's only done locally, you know, and locally could mean from here to, you know, other countries, or it could mean from here to Alpha Centauri or beyond, but it's just a map. So I think that advanced species are probably among the best, absolutely best cartographers in the universe, because they've mapped those exit points and entry points, you know. So let's suppose they can do that. How would they travel? How would those craft appear to look to us, to our eyes? Our eyes only see our four-dimensional stuff and only a very narrow range of it, right? We only see out to about here, then this is all infrared, then out to about here, that's all blue. See, longer wavelength, shorter wavelength. Okay, so the blue and beyond is short wavelength and very, very high frequency. Okay, the longer wavelength, low frequency stuff is out here. And we see this narrow band in the middle. We're kind of crippled and hobbled when it comes to seeing what's out in the universe. So we don't see all the rest. But all of that is within our four dimensions. All of it. Okay? The infrared's not outside of our four dimensions. Neither is the ultraviolet or gamma rays or X-rays or cosmic rays. all that we know is in the four dimensions. And now we're being asked to consider that there's a fifth dimension that we don't know. And so if we could go into the fifth dimension, it means that we could go from point A to point B without traveling every point between point A and point B. Now, that's really good news, because if we know that point B is clear of meteors and you know, asteroids, and we leave point A, well, we know we can materialize, come in at point B. And who cares if there was, you know, comets and meteors traveling between point A and point B? We don't care. You know, we just have to know not to do that into a star, you know, or inside a building down on Earth if we're going across the planet or something. Right. So the bottom line is the ships don't need engines. They just need the ability to make these particles. And what do we do when we want to make particles? What's the technology that we use?
Tell me, sir.
You know.
You're the science guy.
I know, but you know. Okay. We use particle accelerators to generate new types of particles, don't we? Yeah. And what shape are our particle accelerators typically?
I don't know.
Okay. The Large Hadron Collider, what's that? It's a big ring.
Okay.
Big ring, 300 feet underground, right? Now, why is it underground? Because that eliminates any dangerous radiation from getting out. Because whenever you constrain charged particles, like charged protons, when you try to constrain them to go in a circle, they give off synchrotron radiation laterally along the way. All if they're going through a tube like this, straight at you like this, like tube, well, they're giving off synchrotron radiation in every other direction when they're being forced to go in a circle. And synchrotron radiation, that's not good for us. So even though they're shielded at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, that's something that's very, very important, is to mitigate the danger of synchrotron radiation. That said, you know, we talk about UFOs and we talk about extraterrestrial life and we say, well, what shape are UFOs? Oh, they're discs or they're triangles. Oh, disc. I imagine that a disc is basically a particle accelerator on the outside ring, and the occupants are in the middle. And that disc in the outside ring is generating Kaluza-Klein particles, which generates these gravitons. And these gravitons allow them to slip out of our four dimensions into the fifth. And then they can just, you know, reduce the number of particles while having an entry point programmed in. However they do that, that's something we don't even know how to do. Okay, and then boom, they're there. So to go across the sky, a UFO isn't traveling across the sky in a straight line. It doesn't have any speed. Now, that's crazy, right? Because you watch these UFOs travel at high speed. What they're doing is just popping out and popping in at the new spot. So pop, 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 pop to the occupants in the ship. Even if the thing goes like this and zigzags, you know, through the sky really, really sharply, the occupants aren't feeling any forces. They're just watching the scenery change outside their windows, so to speak. Okay, because no, there's no inertial forces whatsoever on them. They're not moving. They're just popping into a new location, popping into a new location, popping into a new location. And to our eyes, we're seeing it go in a 90-degree pattern that looks like what looks like thousands of miles an hour. But it's not. It's moving 0 miles an hour from the perspective of the occupants of the craft. So you could be sitting there sleeping, you know. Meanwhile, your ship's going ding, 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 all over the sky, zigzagging all over the place, you know, and it wouldn't matter. In this same way, these craft could then oscillate back and forth from this fifth dimension and our dimension, going back and forth rapidly at some frequency, okay? And that rapid vibration or oscillation back and forth at whatever frequency they're doing it at would mean they're neither here nor there. Okay. And as they do this vibration, they're neither here nor there for any appreciable amount of time. So as long as their ship is generating these particles down wherever they are, they could be underneath the ocean. They could be deep in the ocean. And as long as the ship just continues to hum and produce these particles, all right, they're fine. They don't feel any ocean pressure because they're not really there. They're half in, half out at any one moment. Kind of like the electron is a cloud. It's not really a particle per se. We can talk about it like that, but it's everywhere at once. which is really, really hard to fathom, you know, because you think we think of things as having finite speed. So it's hard to imagine a particle that can be everywhere at once. And you'd be right. You can't have a particle that's everywhere at once. But if your particle was actually being thought of as a wave, okay, then the wave equation satisfies the ability to have things everywhere at once, because it generates it can basically be anywhere within the sphere around this proton. So that's kind of what's going on with these UFOs. They're neither here nor there. So they can be here. They can be there. Okay. If they turn off their power source that makes these particles, they will be in one spot. And they will be physically thinking you can touch them. You'll, hey, that's real. Okay. So, and that's happened before. When that happens, well, sometimes there's crashes, right? Sometimes we can bring them down too. That's been one of the ongoing thought processes, actually. But so it's really interesting how this works. And like I said, I think Bob Schroeder is right about this. I'm not the only one that thinks this way. I've mentioned this, I think, before. I worked with Avi Loeb on several television programs and stuff. I know Avi. He's a great guy. Okay. And it was only this past year he came out and said, you know, I think aliens may travel interdimensionally. Yes, of course. So, you know, so more and more science, including, and he's Harvard's astrophysics chair. So, I mean, this guy is no slouch. Okay. So when you hear comments like that come from guys like that, and I've been talking about the Kaluza-Klein particles for many years now, and that's the thing that resonates with me. And apparently it resonates with a lot of other scientists out there too. So I'm pretty comfortable saying that we should look into this. And at CERN over in at the overseas, they were experimenting and making particles by accelerating these protons in this very large 22-mile ring. Okay. And when they get them up near the speed of light, they collide, and they have one particular detector on there called ATLAS, ATLAS, all caps. And the ATLAS detector in part was there to do what? Explore Kaluza-Klein particles. And they found some really interesting stuff there. Okay. So now the question is, how could a UFO make these particles over and over and over and over and over again? Well, actually, pretty easily, if you want to consider it easy, once you have a certain piece of technology. And for that technology, we don't go to CERN, we go to Lawrence Livermore Lab. Lawrence Livermore over in California is working on the concept of fusion. And a fusion reactor at the heart of your UFO is what you would need and what you could use to generate your Kaluza-Klein particles. And if you can generate enough of your particles, you can then surround your ship with them, and you could then be pulled into that fifth dimension, and now interstellar travels at your doorstep. And once you can do that, you're still probably a few hundred years away from doing it, because you still have to figure out exit and entry points. Where do you go into this fifth dimension, and where do you come back to? And, but I'll give you an example. I'll say it this way. Let's suppose, you know, to see how this works, why does it work? What's this fifth dimension do for you? That would be a good question. Now, if you think about it, that fifth dimension is not like our four dimensions, of course. That four dimensions, if we travel 12 inches in that our four dimensions, that's 1 foot as we've defined it. Now, let's do that same 12 inches. But this time we're going to go into the fifth dimension before we do it. Now, in the fifth dimension, the universe gets smaller. The farther in you go, it's highly warped. The farther in you go, the universe is smaller and smaller all around you. So that same 1 foot of travel that you travel in that fifth dimension translates to a whopping large distance when you come back out into the four dimensions, because you're covering more distance because the universe is much smaller around you. So if you travel 12 inches, so to speak, in that location, or 1 foot, when you come out, that's stretched to some much bigger distance. So in other words, you could and this is just an analogy, it's not correct numerically. You could travel 12 inches in that fifth dimension, which would translate to, say, the distance from here to the moon when you come out. So that would correspond to, say, a ship going instantly from Earth to the moon. Instantly. Now, or you know, the only time it takes is the time it takes to go a distance in this fifth dimension. It's sort of like that. So the bottom line is that when you look at this warped fifth dimension, okay, it offers up a travel methodology that is something that's completely foreign to us, but was hypothesized back in the 20s and 30s. Okay, so you can see that the Kaluza-Klein hypothesis is very controversial, but science is starting to see that there's really no other way they could travel. I mean, there is. I mean, we could imagine generation ships, right, where aliens live and die in the ship and they reproduce on the ship and the people that arrive here are not the people that left. You know, yeah, I'm sure that could all happen. But it's also possible that, you know, the same folks could like come to Earth and say, I got to pop over to Proxima Centauri. I'll be back in about 4 hours Earth time. And they could just pop over to Alpha Centauri, go to Proxima, check something out, come back, say in like 2 or 3 hours, 4 hours. You know, I envision a time when we'll go to Pluto for lunch. I do. I mean, it because Pluto would be minutes away, if not seconds, based on this methodology. And that's a far future methodology. And it's so far future that many people say, that's a bunch of baloney. That's crazy. That can't happen. That's sci-fi. Mm-hmm. You know what? Going faster than the speed of sound was sci-fi once too. So.
Wow.
Now.
Wow, that's, yeah.
When
it's
I
a lot to wrap your head around.
It yeah. is, it is. And when I mentioned the underwater, like with them, they could be in the bottom of the ocean. Okay. Again, because they don't have engines, they're just popping in, you know, they go out to the fifth dimension and pop in underwater. So to our sensors, to our sonar sensors, for instance, on a submarine, they would see something traveling in a line. Okay. What they don't see is that it's popping out, going to a fifth dimension and coming back. All they just see is the sonar signal moving across the sonar in the way that it does. And that sonar signal moving the way it does is something that is, you know, built into our acquisition systems, the way we see things underwater, quote unquote. Okay. So we see the little acoustic signature it makes when it pops back in. Because when it pops back in, it is displacing water. And that makes some kind of a signal because a very, very rapid displacement of water. So that's going to make a noise. And that's what shows up in the sonar. And you see a rapid succession of those, and it looks like something moving through the water. And that's what they see. And when I was on a submarine as a guest, oh gosh, decades and decades ago, actually, I saw... I didn't see it. The sonar guy registered something moving through the sonar at several hundred knots. Now that's several hundred miles an hour. And that's a very fast moving object. And I was blown away when he called the con and he said, con sonar, fast mover. And the executive officer walked around. And to me, I thought fast mover was a torpedo and then we're about to die. I mean, we're in the North Atlantic here. And I'm like, oh my God, why did they agree to go on this trip? I just come along, I tell people as an observer. Okay. But the bottom line is I could die out here. And that's a horrible, I don't want to die. I don't want that. What's going on? And the executive officer kind of saunters around from the con, which is right around the corner of this little cluster of sonar, four sonar stations. And he goes around the corner and comes back. And he said, what do you got? And he's like acting so calm. And I'm thinking, a little more speed. This could be a torpedo, dude. Okay. And the kid called it a transient. He said it was a fast mover. Here it is. The trace was working its way up, I guess. and something like that. And he said, "How? What's the bearing in the range on that thing?" Now the kid was facing away from me, so I didn't hear that part. And the XO was up here looking down at the kid, and the kid's looking away from me, you know. And he says to the XO, "The bearing in the range." And he says, "What's the speed?" The XO says, and the kid does something, and he says, and now he's incredulous, and he turns to the side with his arms out to his side, and he says, "Several hundred knots, sir." And he holds his hands there. He goes, "They're moving them." He doesn't know what to do. He's never seen anything like this before. So the executive officer says, "Okay, log it and dog it." And the kid went, "Sir, yes, sir." And he turned around, went back to the state, to his sonar, and that was the end of it. Now, I didn't let that be the end of it, of course, because I'm a busybody and I had to tell him, you know, I'm a VIP on this ship, on this boat, man. So I should get answers. And you can probably guess where it's going. So I got up and I went to the XO. "Sir, XO, excuse me. I'm very familiar with these fast movers. Is there something I can help you with?" He looks at me and he goes, "D'Antonio, correct?" I said, "Sir, yes, sir." "So you're having a good trip, sir?" I go, I sure am, sir, yes, sir." He goes, "Let's keep it that way." And he walks away. He's like, "Oh my God."
Wow.
Yeah. So a few years later, I have a business that I started back in, early 90s, where I do work for the Navy and stuff. And I had to do a project for the Navy, but I was actually doing it for the Joint Chiefs. And at that time, I brought this project down to Washington, and it was after the submarine incident. And I went to the chief, one of the president's staff, okay, on the chief of the Navy, and I sat with him and I asked him, "What can you tell me about the fast mover program?" And I delivered the package to him, the thing that I made. And I said, "Is there anything you can tell me about the fast mover program?" I said, "Because I experienced one on one of the boats." And he looked at me and he goes, "I'm sorry, Mark, I can't talk about that program." And I was like, oh,
wow.
I mean, that went through me like you can't believe. Okay. It was incredible because I drove back from Washington in a daze. I almost didn't know where the time went. Suddenly I was home. You know, and it's a 5.5 hour, 6 hour drive. And I just didn't, all I was thinking of all the way home was, it's real. And I just was going over and over in my head. I couldn't wait to get home because I wanted to start digging into some research as best I could. And so that's, you know, when I was on the boat, that was the thing. That was the first time I had ever actually heard about a USO, unknown submerged object. You know, we have unidentified flying objects, but unidentified submerged objects. That's weird. I didn't know anything about USOs at the time. So that was my first experience, and I wasn't sure what it was. And when I started looking into it, I discovered most likely not ours, you know, most likely not theirs either, but theirs, you know, up there, up in the sky from some distant place. So that's really interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, why do you think? Do you think that the reason, I mean, look, I say this a lot. I actually just said it yesterday to somebody, but, you know, I remember, I mean, I'm 44, but I remember in the 80s, 90s, whenever there were, you know, supposed UFO sightings, you know, they would kind of, it was almost like a joke on the news, you know, like it was always like, "Oh yeah, there was a UFO sighting. It was this, it was that," and blah, blah, blah. And it was like a fluff piece almost.
Exactly.
Now it's not anymore. Now they're taken very, very seriously.
That is correct. You know? They are. And in fact, if you look at the different industries, there's a number of industries now that are actually no longer scrutinized for reporting UFOs. Among them are pilots. Now, when pilots report UFOs, there is no ridicule. There is no, you know, you get a psychological exam. None of that stuff anymore. Now it's like, yeah, you and a lot of other people, you know, you and a lot of other people. So they know it. They now they expect it. And I think that's pretty cool.
Now, not to get into, you know, because I don't talk about political stuff or anything like that. But why do you think it's so secretive? Is it like mass hysteria? They don't want to cause mass hysteria.
No, people not go at all.
Crazy over
so.
Not, you know, of knowing this stuff, or people, you know, because, you know, there's going to be people that are going to be questioning God and religion and of all course. This stuff when this, you know, yeah. Is it? Why do you think it's so secretive? You know, I mean, it's out there. I mean, we see it everywhere. I mean, they've been kind of even grooming us for a long time too, with all these alien movies and alien TV shows. And, you know, it's always out there.
Yep. I mean, one of my talks I do is, about part of it's about Hollywood, not grooming us per se, but, preparing without right. realizing it. Because I don't think they realize it. They're just doing what they think is popular, but it's actually preparing us. And then we have aliens that eat our brains. We have aliens that come to save our lives. We have aliens that are benevolent and cute. E.T., phone home, you know, Elliot, right. you know, that we have creatures that are invisible and become visible. We have creatures that steal children and, you know, like sightings or signs rather. That was a good movie. Okay. Right. So, I mean, stuff like that, but see, we have these benevolent aliens. We have movies about aliens that created the human race, and we're very disappointed, and we're just going to wipe it off the earth. Okay. And start over, Prometheus. Okay. We have movies about aliens that just want to destroy us for some reason. Okay. Independence Day. Okay. You know, we also have movies about aliens living among us, like Men in Black. Okay.
Right.
So Hollywood this is science fiction. And it's not like anyone is an insider giving them all the clues about what to do. I think that it's just their way of saying, we know they're out there. Okay. We'd like to believe they're here to help us. Okay. Day the earth stood still. Okay. We're hoping they're not here to harm us, or, you know, just be absolutely indiscriminate killing machines, alien. Okay. We hope they don't want to hunt us, predator. Okay. We're hoping they don't want to, destroy us. And again, Independence Day, like I said. So the idea is that the movies just touch upon all the different thought processes people have about why there's aliens here if they come here. Okay. And that's healthy. That's good. I don't mind that we do that. I think that's probably important that we speculate on what their motivations are. But one thing we have to be careful to do is to not impose our morality on them. Okay. We can't say that an alien race, and I'll get to the secretive part in a minute, but we can't say that an alien race is here to help us because they want us to grow, because they want to be our friends, because they want to just gently bring us into the galactic fold. Okay. That's not, we can't dare to impose that. Our morality is based on our evolution specifically. All right. It's based on our DNA. We don't know what alien DNA looks like, and we don't know if it's going to have the same desire to keep us from harming ourselves, like in the day the earth stood still, and warn us about it, okay, or not. We don't know. So we can't do that. We can't impose our morality. Now, the question is, you know, when we go to the other question you had about why is it so secretive? Well, there's two reasons it's secretive. Number one, because they don't have any clue. They don't have anything to say because they don't have any idea. And so if you don't have any idea, the last thing you want to do is tell the population that's saying, hey, there's aliens here. No, we don't know where it is. Okay. You'd be better off to say, oh, that's just some kind of top secret project or whatever. And I happen to know that for a fact because I've been in that world for decades, and I did projects that I couldn't tell anybody about. And one of them was a flying craft that was mistaken for a UFO. And the case came to me with photos. I went, oh, I know exactly what that is. I know exactly what that is. All right. I got to handle this safely, carefully. All right. I want them to know that this isn't a UFO. It's one of ours. It turns out it's something called the MPUAV or Project Cormorant. If you look up a Project Cormorant on Wikipedia, you'll see the project I'm talking about, right? So you can look it up and you'll see that you have this flying craft that looked rather malevolent with these wings that were really heavily steeped and then curved upward at the end. It looked like a UFO, this gaping maw on the front. It turns out that's the air intake for the engine. Okay. This was basically like a missile that flew reconnaissance sorties. Okay. And it would fly around and they were testing it in Lake Pendere out in Bayview, Idaho. And someone saw it and took photos of it and sent me the photos. And they said, look, a UFO. It's a UFO. I'm like, yes, it's unidentified to you, but it's not a UFO. But I couldn't say what it was because at the time it was still something I was working on that I couldn't talk about. So I called the program office down in Washington. And they start with the acronyms PMS. Go figure. Okay. PMS 317 is the San Antonio class LPD project, for instance. And I did a bunch of those as well. And so I called the PMS office for this particular project, for Cormorant, and said, you got someone that's sending pictures of your birdie. And we affectionately called it the birdie. I said, and they think it's a UFO. And the guy laughed. Oh, good. That's good news. Why? He goes, they'll just never be able to, no one will ever take them seriously. Let me tell you how that's going to go. There's one guy who's going to go back to his friends at the resort, which is at the other end of this lake, and say, guys, come with me. There's a UFO at the other end of the lake. And they're all going to get in their cars and with their cameras, and they're going to race down, and one photographer will be get 10, and those 10 will be get another 20. Those 20 and 30 will be get another 50. And next thing you know, you're going to have an entire cadre of paparazzi down there photographing your birdie. And you're not going to want them to photograph certain elements of this. So all you need to do to stop all of this is to just generate an email, which I'll distribute, that says it's ours. Okay. You do that and they'll all go home. And he said, you sure? And after a pause, he came back and said, oh, okay, yeah, you might be right. A letter, you want this? No, just send me an email. He sent me an email. I passed it back to the guy that sent the case in. Told him exactly what it was, you know, from the limits I could at the time. And they all went home. They never submitted another photograph. And it was like, oh, it's one of ours. All right, never mind. False alarm, guys. That's basically what it was. And that's okay. That's okay. So so that's an example of sometimes what happens, right? But so we get some government projects that are mistaken as alien. And so that is part of the reason why a lot of it's so secretive, is because one agency doesn't know what everybody else is doing. They're very narrow pyramids of clearances, okay? You climb that clearance pyramid, and you have a top secret clearance way up here in the top of your pyramid. But then there's another pyramid next to you for another project, and you're not read into that project, so you don't know what they're doing. So you don't know if what is being reported, all right, and asked about is something that is one of these other agencies that are working on all these different all these different avenues of clearance. Maybe it's one of their projects and you dare not say anything. So what's the best thing to do is say nothing. And so that's why it's been kept so secret, because you reported to, if one agency hears about it, I know exactly what they're going to say. They're going to say to their crew, do we know it? Is there, no, get some interagency people in here. We got to find out who else is working. Maybe this is someone else's project that someone's seeing, you know, and until then they're not going to say a word. And that's the right thing to do, you know? So that's why it's kept secret as well. For one case, they don't know. In the other case, it might be some other agency's black project that we got to be careful not to talk about it.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So can you tell me a little bit about SkyTour Radio and SkyTour Livestream?
Absolutely. You know, SkyTour Radio, started after SkyTour Livestream, but I'll tell you, I'll start with SkyTour Livestream. As an astronomer, I've always wanted to do outreach. I wanted to show people the universe and just let them see gorgeous night sky objects in the same way that I'm used to seeing them. And I had a telescope here on my front lawn. That's how we started. And that telescope is actually right there. That telescope you're seeing right there, that telescope, I know that the audience can't see this, but there's a big telescope in the background here where we're talking. And that telescope is the original SkyTour live stream telescope. I installed it in an actual dome on my front lawn, a big round dome. And it was the talk of the town because I was the only one in the whole town that has a dome. And cars would go by, stop, go, what is that? I think it's a missile silo, Edna. I don't know about that, Mel. Okay. And, you know, I get all kinds of things. I think it's a composter. Okay. Well, it looked like a composter, I guess. Big one. Well, bottom line was that I wanted to have an observatory so that I didn't have to go set up a telescope every night. Okay. The next thing I wanted to do was to be able to broadcast what we saw to the world. So I first began by getting a powerful PC out in my dome, which I left out there 24/7, 12 months a year. And I could go out there and start up. I had headphones and a microphone, and I would connect to YouTube. I'd start streaming from there. Okay. And I would share what we're doing and show people images. It was somewhat primitive. And now I outgrew the dome. That's why the telescope's in here. I'm rehabbing the telescope to get it in shape for another project we're working on. And I sold the dome to a fellow on Long Island who wanted a smaller dome. So I sold him my 8-foot dome. And so he took it. The conditions were you got to come disassemble it and then you can have it. And I sold it to him for more than I paid for it because they're actually hard to come by. So that said, I decided that Connecticut skies are terrible. I didn't have to decide that. They are. Okay. And so being that the skies are so bad, I wanted something that was going to be a little bit darker. No, I wanted something that was going to be a lot a bit darker. Okay. So I went to Arizona. I got to a friend's land, a friend of mine out there. In fact, he's a nuclear scientist with Lawrence Livermore. And he has property out in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. It's so dark out there, you cannot see your hand in front of your face. When you look up at the sky at night, it makes you cry. There's so many stars. They're just everywhere. They carpet the sky. The Milky Way goes horizon to horizon without fail. Right down to the mountains. You see it cross behind the mountains on both sides, all the way across the sky. So I asked them, I said, geez, you know, would you ever consider letting me put up an observatory on your property? Oh, yeah. Whoa, okay. So we did. In fact, today was a maintenance day that the other two people that do this with me were out there doing maintenance, and I was watching on my security cameras. I was watching them go in and do all the things they're doing. We're talking about everything they're doing. We put in the telescope. Okay. We put in the building. We built the building out there. And I designed a system to very simply to roll the whole roof right off the building. It's not an uncommon design. It's called a roll-off roof, an ROR, a roll-off roof observatory. The roof comes off, and now it's totally exposed to the outside elements. The temperature mixes, and the telescope comes to an ambient temperature very quickly. With a dome, it takes longer because it's one little slit. And, you know, with the roof off, it gave us access to the sky everywhere. It was beautiful. And, after our show tonight, I'm probably going to stream live, actually. Nice. We'll see. And then having a telescope in the Sonoran, we actually made that one a wide field telescope. So it can see a field of view that's 3 full moons across and 2 full moons tall. So it's a pretty big field. So you can see gigantic nebulas and stellar nurseries, places where life is probably beginning if it hasn't already, very easily with this telescope. It runs 25 times faster than a stock telescope of its kind. And then we decided, because I wanted a what's called a higher focal length, more magnification, smaller field, we decided to put in a second observatory. So 220 miles to the southeast of this one is one out in the Benson Plateau in Arizona. And the sky is marginally darker there than it is in the Sonoran, believe it or not. So in that location, we put in a telescope that was a little bigger than the previous, but wasn't going to be made 25 times faster. We're going to use it stock, and we're going to add a number of additional instrumentation packages to it to give us other capabilities. So SkyTour Livestream has now blossomed to these two observatories in Arizona. And when we stream them live. And so you're seeing the universe live in real time. And people get to see this beautiful things materialize right before their eyes in just a few seconds. Distant galaxies that are 80, 100 million light years away. Oh, man. You know, and then so SkyTour Livestream was great. SkyTour Radio started as a radio show that'd be a complimentary show to the SkyTour Livestream. And we're on KGRA, so we actually have some good reach. We're on, you can find us on Spreaker. You can find us on all the other typical places, iHeartRadio, all that stuff. On there, we do a two-hour radio show. We just changed our day. We went from a Sunday, 6 to 8 p.m., to Wednesday nights, 8 to 10. And that's actually a good slot for us because at 10, Clyde Lewis, who's a nationally international syndicated show, comes on. So we're leading up to Clyde Lewis, which is very nice. And there we do astronomical topics. We talk about things. I actually will do, I have an endless number of talks that I've given. So I just bring up one of those talks and we go through it. And I take questions from the people watching too, just like with SkyTour Livestream. Somebody wants to see something. Somebody wants to talk. They want to ask a question. We take their questions. We also have a store called SkyTour Shop on Etsy. We have a Patreon. We love to get Patreon subscribers. I just got an email from another guy. I want to join. I don't know how. So I got to show him how. So there's a lot of good stuff. We even have some big donors. We just won a grant from Asterion Foundation, which allows us now to buy a third instrument for the Benson Observatory. We're going to buy what's called a spectrograph. It allows us, we'll take photographs of an object, let's say like the Orion Nebula, beautiful gas, wispy clouds. And then with the spectrograph, we can analyze the composition of the cloud. So people see a beautiful image, which we give away for free. Okay. And then they can actually get the spectral analysis, which shows them, well, this is oxygen, this is hydrogen. And look, we see a bunch of other elements in here. Okay. Look at this iron isotope. Well, look at this, but this is calcium, you know? And so in other words, you see the periodic table in almost everywhere we look, okay, in the universe. And this instrument will help us see that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. Now,
and I run it from Connecticut. And they both observatories are 2,500 miles away. So I run them from here.
Wow.
Yeah.
And actually, that leads me up to this other thing, too. Now, why do you think, I'd probably say, I mean, I'm sure in your mind, it's probably a bit different. But to somebody like me that's, I guess, not into everything that you do, why just in the past maybe 2 years or so have we been having all these celestial events? I mean, all these planet alignments, all these, you know, you could see the aurora borealis from everywhere all the time now when you weren't able to do that. All these eclipses. What's changed in the last couple of years that all this stuff is happening?
The only thing that's changed is the media has become more in tune. Okay. They've been occurring. They've not slowed down. They've not sped up. Okay. The aurora borealis, that corresponds to times when we're at what's called a solar maximum, which we are at now. And the solar maximum is when you'll see lots of sunspots on the sun's surface. Think of those as disrupted areas in the magnetic field of the sun. And so they tend to give off flares. Those flares tend to be particles of actual matter, like high energy protons and electrons. and they come racing toward the Earth. And when they strike our magnetic field, they spiral down around the poles, north and south, and make the aurora borealis on the north side and the aurora australis down south. And so we see lots of auroras. So at times of solar maximum, which happens every 11 years, then this can be something that's common, you know? And when the media gets a whiff of it, they're like, oh, this is cool. But they may, again, may not have a good understanding. So they might say, this is something we've never seen. This is rare. Right. And they make it rare, therefore, and it's not. It's just something that happens all the time. If you lived in northern latitudes and you were an astronomer, you would hate the northern lights because they're out there every single night. We have an auroral oval that's constantly around the northern hemisphere. If you go up to, if you're at like 60 or so north latitude, you'd have auroras every night that are interfering with your astrophotos. So they're always there.
And what are your thoughts on the, I actually think it's funny too, because right leading up to this interview with you, I think just before, I received a message from SkyTor saying that you guys were going to be talking about this. But what are your thoughts on the recent discovery? I'm not even going to say this name, but of DMS, which is the molecule, you know, on planet K2-18b, I believe it's called.
That's dimethyl sulfate. Yeah.
Right.
This dimethyl sulfate is an interesting compound because you know it well. Okay. You mean, and I might have talked about this when I did the Danbury conference. I'm not sure. But I have a graph that was created. It was of the, again, what was this graph of? It was a spectral response curve showing you the spectra of different elements. See, this is why the spectrograph is such an important instrument, because it shows you the compositions of things that you otherwise wouldn't know. And so we'll have that capability too. But the James Webb saw this dimethyl sulfate in the atmosphere of a planet. Okay, as you said, K2-18b. And this means that in all likelihood, if an accurate result, which it looks like it's been vetted again, and it looks like it's still there. As just recently, I read an article about it. It looks like this DMS or dimethyl sulfate could indicate that there's life there. And now the other thing is, it's a planet that's larger than ours, and it looks like it's mostly water, if not all water. So DMS on our planet is here. All right. Dimethyl sulfate is on our planet as well. But it's at much lower levels. But then again, Earth is smaller and not all water. Okay. Go to a larger planet that's all water, and the DMS level will be higher. So, but what is DMS? What does that mean? Well, okay. DMS, dimethyl sulfate, is a compound that's produced only by life. So on our planet, you know it every time you drive down to the beach, you drive by the shore, and you smell that disgusting smell, you know, when the tide is out. Okay, the smell of that mud. Yeah, that's dimethyl sulfate. And you're smelling, it's kind of a combination of rotten eggs and rotting garbage. Okay. And that's because it's a waste product of bacteria. Okay. And so you're getting the whiff of life. And so it's only produced by life. So if it's true, then the James Webb has found life in another world.
That's, and I mean, just to put it out there for people that are listening too, it's, this planet is 700 trillion miles away.
Yeah, it's a little far away.
A little far. Yeah, it's a little bit.
Yeah. However, let's explain the capability though. Even though it's 700 trillion miles away, keep in mind, and I haven't, I didn't calculate it in miles, but let's keep in mind that the James Webb is a million miles from us. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's looking at this planet. And what happens is when the planet passes in front of its star, okay, We're looking at the star's spectrum. Okay, when the planet passes in front of the star, for a split second while it's passing in front of the star's spectrum changes. And that star's spectrum changes because now some of the atmosphere of the planet, which has some thickness, is infecting the star's spectrum and is stealing some of the energy coming from that star. And that shows up as a line, a dark line in the spectrum. So for a period of time, we're going to see these new lines appear in the star's spectrum, and then they'll go away, and then they'll come back again when the planet's crossing in or leaving. Okay. Because right at that edge is the time when we'll actually see that very edge of the atmosphere hitting the star, and then that's when we can actually detect the atmosphere. It's got to be a very specialized situation, though. The planet has to pass in front of the star as seen from the Earth. Hmm. Yeah.
And now, what about the other planet? The name escapes me, about the artificial lights. What's that about?
You're talking about Proxima.
Yes, Proxima B, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, they said there's artificial light. That's just bogus. Yeah, there's some stories out there. The James Webb isn't seeing lights on Proxima B, okay? Or Proxima C, which I think is also a planet out there that they're talking about now. That's just
media trying to.
No, that's just the internet.
Get some stories.
That's just right. Somebody decided they'd have some fun. Those aren't valid findings at this point.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Unfortunately.
Right. Right. Yeah. It would be kind of exciting.
Yeah.
So what do you have coming up in the near future?
Let's see. April 24th, May 7th, I have to do a talk, on Kaluza-Klein particles. I'll be doing that at a local, vineyard, May 29th through June 2nd. May 16th through the 18th, I'll be in Colorado teaching class in photo and video analysis for the Colorado Mutual UFO Network folks. That'll be May 16th through the 18th. May 29th to June 2nd, I'll be in Palm Springs, California, doing Contact in the Desert and doing 7 lectures across those days. All different things. And then June 7th, when I get back, on the 3rd, June 7th, I'm in Pine Bush, New York, speaking there. July, I'm in Phoenix. I'll be in Phoenix again in between all that because I'm administering the observatories as well. And June 7th, I'll be in Pine Bush doing a lecture at Pine Bush, New York as well. And so I forgot about that. So and then September, I'm in Shag Harbor in Nova Scotia at that conference. And I heard today that I might, there's a possibility I might be speaking in Albuquerque in October on my birthday, the 17th.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. So if that happens, and beyond that, there's just the filming for The Proof Is Out There with the History Channel. I've been on that show for 5 years now. And so I've been doing a lot with them. In fact, they got an emergency. I got to do one thing here in the next several days. A new case came up for this season that they want me to quickly do as well. But normally we do like 10 stories at a time, 10, 12 stories at a time. And they come here, they set up, we film here, which is why my entire office space is so nicely set up. It's set up for filming already.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of cool. And then, other than that, besides Proof Is Out There, the occasional TV show, news story, stuff like that, radio show. I've been a busy guy, I got a lot of stuff
going on. It sounds like it.
Yeah.
It definitely sounds like it.
And meanwhile, I'm building models for the Navy.
Definitely are a busy guy. I thought I was busy. Jeez.
No, we're all busy in ways one way or another. Pick your poison, right?
Right. So June 7th is the Pine Bush UFO Festival.
Yeah.
Actually, my buddy who helps me with my podcast, John Wright, is also, he's a MUFON investigator in the New York chapter. And he actually works at the Pine Bush Museum. He does tours there every Sunday, but I believe he's going to be there for that event too. Yeah. Excellent. I mean, super smart guy. He's a teacher and he does a lot of, things for me with podcasts.
Well, then he's seen my work because,
absolutely. He said he met you. Yeah.
Yeah.
He said he's met you.
And as a, see, I also have my model making company is also the visual effects. And so I've done television work with the famous Douglas Trumbull for 10 years. Okay. He did Close Encounters, Blade Runner. I mean, all these, you know, wow. He's worked with all the greats. I haven't, but he has. He worked with Jim Cameron. Okay. He worked with all kinds of people. And he passed away a few years ago, which was a terrible event for the community. But he was a good friend of mine. And, you know, he taught me so much about visual effects that I thought I knew, I didn't know until I met him. So for 10 years, I learned under him. I went from being an assistant on the set for one commercial to being there all the time with him working on all kinds of projects. And he called, he called me his chief scientist, which is great. You know, it's kind of funny. I remember one particular, there was a crew that came in and they had designed these spaceships for their show that they were doing. It was a movie about a guy going to Mars all alone. And he designed the ship. And I looked at the ship and I said to Doug, Doug, how much leeway do you have here on helping them with the design of their ships? And he goes, why, is something wrong with their ships? I go, yeah, yeah, it won't work. Okay, they had this one ship in the center like this. And then and it had this armature sticking off of it, okay, like a radial spoke. And they had another ship on the end of it that was going around the central spoke. And that was supposed to give artificial gravity to that thing on the end of the spoke based on how fast that was rotating. That's sound. Okay. Except that in space where there's no forces acting on it, this thing, this little guy moving around is also going to induce motion on the big thing. And they're actually going to do this to each other and go into chaotic motion. And I tried to tell, I told that to Doug and he goes, oh, you better tell him. How can they fix it? Well, just make another arm coming out the other side that has a counterweight and it'll all be balanced. As long as they balance the forces, they'll be fine. So in the meeting, I started talking about that. And the guy that was, you know, in charge of all this said, and we've got this figured out. Thank you very much. And Doug goes, if Mark says it's not going to work, it's not going to work. You might want to listen. Okay. And they went, oh, yes, sir, Doug, the Academy Award winner, right, Doug? So they said, oh, well, tell us, Mark, what's wrong? And now now they want to listen. See, but with Doug there, it was that was easy pickings because he knew what I was talking about. And so anyway, so that's an example. Like, so he was one of these guys that would just be totally willing to work with you. I mean, it didn't matter who you were. We did a show, we did a movie about Nikola Tesla, and we were shooting inside 300 feet underground in a dam up in New York State near Niagara Falls. And we had this shot, it was done in 3D, and we had this one shot where you're on a golf cart, okay, and you get through, it's a half mile long facility underground. And you drive golf carts to go one place to another. And I said to Doug, why don't we put the camera on a golf cart and speed down this hallway in 3D and just like impart the motion of all these things sticking out? And Doug went, I love this idea. So he actually wrote it into the script and he says at the end, I want this to be Mark's shot. Note that. I was like, wow. that's the kind of guy he was. He was like everybody's that's grandfather, cool. The nicest guy in the world, you know, and very humble. He didn't have to be. He had every right to be a big bragging blowhard, but he never was. He had every right to be. So anyway, so that's the story about that. But anyway.
That's awesome. So how could someone find you, find out more information about everything that you're doing? And
sure. They can go to skytourlive.org. That's skytourlive, SkyTourLive.org. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit. And skytourlive.org. And you can go through the contact us form. You can check out what we do, see our streams, come to the YouTube channel and see us. pop into our streams, say hi, say hello. I make a point of saying hello to everyone who comes in our streams. The only time I don't get a chance to say hi to everyone is if we crest over like 1,000 people watching. Could I be saying hi all night long? Right. We did a lunar eclipse in 2019, actually. It was a long time ago. We had over 5,000 people watching at one time. And those 5,000 people got to see something no one else in the world got to see. Not live anyway, and not recorded, which is up on our site. And that is a meteor hitting the moon at the height of a lunar eclipse.
Wow.
We caught a flash of a meteor striking the moon right in the blood red part of the moon.
Wow.
So really cool stuff. Yeah. And there's only five other people on the planet that caught it. And our observatory was one of them. Very cool. Yeah.
That's awesome. So, all right. One last question. To me, this is probably one of the most important questions of the night. So is Katy Perry now an astronaut because she left Earth's atmosphere for 11 minutes?
Well, going above the Kármán line for 11 minutes is probably not qualifying you. I think what she was actually, to be fair, cargo. They were all cargo.
Okay? Right.
They did nothing except get up there, scream, float around. Now, would I like to do it? Of course I would. It'd be fun. Okay.
Sure.
But, you know, there's all kinds of conspiracies online. The Blue Origin craft is nice and clean when it comes back. Look at the Dragon capsule. Well, the Dragon capsule had to slow down from 17,500 miles an hour and use the atmosphere to do it. The air will break in, you know, that's called reentry. Well, the Blue Origin capsule just goes straight up and straight down. Okay. It's an elevator. It's not an orbital vehicle. Okay. Right. It has no capability. So is Katy Perry an astronaut? No, she had, what was it, 11 hours of training or just like 2 days of training. And that was to basically learn how to put their seatbelt on. No lie. Okay. And do other things. And that's okay. That's important.
Sure.
And so, but the term astronaut is applied to people that work in space. Okay. That's not what these women were. They're not working in space. They're on a trip to the suborbital flight is what it is. Suborbital.
Right.
It's not an orbital flight. They never got up to those speeds at all. They just went above the Kármán line, which is where we define space beginning after. And that altitude, poke your nose above that and come back down. Yay. And while you're falling back down, you're weightless, you know? So.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So no, they're not astronauts. In fact, to Gail King's credit, Gail King used to be a news anchor in the state here. Everybody liked her, still do. She said, I have trouble being called an astronaut. And she's like me in that regard. I've never talked to her, never met her, but she's like me in that regard. Astronauts live in space and work in space. I visited for 11 minutes. For 4 minutes, if you want to count the total time they were in microgravity. And so therefore, I can't call myself an astronaut. And I thought that was the right thing, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So no, they're not astronauts.
So thanks. Thank you so much for the interview, man. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
You know, I've been wanting to get you on here since I saw the, since I was at your lecture and everything. So I appreciate this.
Cool.
And, I'll let you know when everything is on. I'll put all your links and stuff in the show notes so everybody could find you and
find all your
stuff. And hopefully I'll see you on June 7th too, because Pinebush is literally only about a half hour from me.
Oh, really?
And I took my 8-year-old to the festival last year.
Okay.
And she loved it. She goes, when are we going to go again? So
we'll
go on June 7th.
June 7th. So. And Pinebush is now on June 7th because I said to the people that run it, you're trying to have it at the time when Contact in the Desert is going live. And it's like May 31st, actually, to June 2nd is Contact. And you have it that weekend of June 2nd or whatever that is. I said, go a week later and you can get a lot more people to attend because anyone who's anyone is at the Contact conference, you know, and you're not going to get anyone here. So you want the Contact conference, then you've got to do it on the time when they can do this. So change the date and you can get speakers here. And they did. So
That's good.
So I think Nick Pope will be there with me this year.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know Nick. He's a funny guy. A lot of stories about Nick.
So thanks again, Mark. I really appreciate it. And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you so much. We'll see you later. All right.
Have a good night.
You too.
Thank you to Mark D'Antonio and John Wright for your awesome contributions for this episode. I really appreciate it. And guys, please stay tuned for more information about the Pine Bush UFO Festival that's coming on June 7th. It's going to be awesome. Mark's going to be there. John's going to be there. A lot of people are going to be there. So you're not going to want to miss it if you're in the area. And if you're not, fly out and come see it. I mean, it's worth it. It's worth it. It's awesome. Maybe I'll be there too. And I'll say hello if you want to come over. So yeah, if you have any paranormal experiences you want to share, 845-600-0744. And let me know about it. You could do so anonymously, or you could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You may be able to win some awesome prizes if we choose you. So that would be very, very cool. Also, please check out everything that the Get Haunted Paranormal Network has to offer. Check out all of their links in the show notes. And yeah, so have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time. Later. Thank you for listening to the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, and thank you to all of my guests and contributors that helped make this show possible. If you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, questions, comments, or you'd like to be a guest in the show, please leave me a voicemail at 845-600-0744, or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, please check out our show notes for all social media links of this show and some of our friends. The Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, uncovering the unseen.